Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey! Are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, fears in Darfur that civilians will be targeted in fighting that has broken out between the army and the militia rapid response forces in Sudan.
The reason why the UN really needs to act now is, according to experts, we're looking at about kill counts and death counts of 110,000 civilian lives. That is equivalent to Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear explosions.
Mali's army claims it has killed a jihadist leader, succeeding where the US and French armies had failed. But what effect will this have on the fight against the insurgency in the Sahel?
Actually, eliminating high-ranking leaders does not really affect a jihadi group. If we look at the historical operations where leaders were killed, it didn't really alter the group's effectiveness, but it is very symbolic.
And we'll meet Dr. Aristide Kamla, the scientist who's found a way of keeping endangered marine mammals called manatees alive, preserving the livelihoods of fishermen in Cameroon, and he's won a prize for it. It's Wednesday, the 1st of May. First, we go to Sudan. The situation there has gone from bad to worse, especially for people who'd been fleeing the fighting in Darfur. The Rapid Support Forces, in its battle with the Sudan Armed Forces, have encircled the main town of Al-Fashir, and fighting has broken out. Around 800,000 civilians are in harm's way. They've been in harm's way for 20 years now, because this is the terrain upon which the RSF first began its murderous campaign against non-Arab Africans through the dreaded Janjaweed. Now the RSF is fighting the army that had spawned it, the Sudan Armed Forces. El-Bashir Idris is an academic and activist who's been watching events in Sudan.
Well, Al-Fashir is currently home to 800,000 civilians, all whom have fled the RSF and their control and attacks over in Darfur since this war began, and even before that with their multiple attacks. And ever since the dissolution of the UN UNAMID mission, RSF have become very bold in their actions, especially in the Darfur area. Now, the reason why the UN really needs to act now is, according to experts, we're looking at about kill counts and death counts of 110,000 civilian lives. That is equivalent to Hiroshima and Nagasaki nuclear explosions. And this is being essentially done by a paramilitary force doing the exact same genocidal actions 20 years ago, to the point even the International Criminal Court intervened and have put out arrest warrants towards those who started and continued with the 2003 Darfur genocide.
For the benefit of people who've been listening to Focus on Africa for a long time and been following the news, when we talk about Darfur, what we remember is that 20 years ago we heard about Janjaweed on horseback laying waste to large areas of Darfur, mainly occupied by non-Arab Africans, and they were being supported by the powers that be in Khartoum. It's not quite the same thing that's happening in terms of who's doing the attacks and the connection to Khartoum. Just explain to us exactly what's happening now is not exactly the same as what happened 20 years ago.
What happened 20 years ago was the Janjaweed essentially was funded and armed by the Sudanese armed forces to essentially target by ethnicity those they've considered not Arab, and hence why we've seen mass ethnic cleansings and genocide 20 years ago. The difference now is that those two partners that work together, not only in ethnically cleansing Darfur, but other places such as the Nuba Mountains around Sudan and other states, these two bullies essentially had a very vicious and horrendous squabble between the two of them. So these two forces that essentially made up the security apparatus of the state have pitted against one another, as one is a military, a state military, and the other one is a paramilitary. And the reason why we're seeing this now is because these two forces and other militia forces around the country were supposed to combine into a national army under a framework agreement. However, what happened just days prior to the war breaking out, the belligerents, the militia leaders and military leaders, they had a falling out over the conditions. And as such, they quickly resulted in use of violent action rather than negotiations and discussions. And this is why we're now seeing the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Why is Al-Fashir and Darfur the grounds upon which this ultimate battle is taking place?
Well, essentially, what we're witnessing here is either the beginning of the end for the RSF or the beginning of a new state for the RSF. And essentially what we're seeing here could potentially lead to the birth of a new nation, though a nation that's not going to be welcomed by its neighbors. Or we could either see the collapse of the militia's power base stronghold within the region.
And that would be the RSF, right? The Rapid Support Forces.
Yes, that would be the Rapid Support Forces, yes.
So essentially we're looking at an almighty battle royal with either the army defeating them or them winning and Darfur splitting off. Is that what we're seeing?
Essentially so. And when I say SAF, SAF, we're also mentioning their allied militias as well, those who are based on ethnic lines as well. Civilians have been targeted ethnically. So, of course, tribes have come together to try and support their own people. And you have this coalition in Al-Fashir of SAF and its allies ready to withstand the aggression of the Rapid Support Forces. However, let's not forget, this is the very same forces that created the Janjaweed, created the RSF just 20 years ago. And unfortunately, regardless of who wins or who loses, it's always the Sudanese people who are going to be caught in the middle. Experts have said from the Yale Humanitarian Research Labs are looking at the damage to be 110,000 people in a city with over 800,000 civilians.
As you were saying, that there are people there who've been fleeing the war in the greater Sudan. I'm wondering is, and this might be sound like a strange question, is this the battle that will end the war, whoever wins?
No, it won't. This is the battle that will either, I won't say end the war, because RSF still have Al Jazeera, which is the agricultural capital of Sudan, and that fell into RSF hands in December just last year. And that still needs to be, say, liberated from them, as the army would say. However, what happens in Al-Fashir will be setting a new precedent going forward into this war and setting conditions that may make this war just continue even much more longer.
So this is a turning point.
This is a real big turning point, yes.
Is it worth asking, how can the war be stopped in Sudan?
Don't know about the war in Sudan completely, but in this situation, Chapter 7 of the UN must be activated, which is essentially peacekeepers.
That takes a long time, peacekeepers. And there were peacekeepers there before. They didn't stop anything.
But the presence of it would help. So even though the current situation is 0%, peacekeepers is 1%. And the situation in Sudan right now with nothing, 0%, it's going to be complete onslaught from what we're looking at. Though I would prefer that 1% of just, I know it's very thin and it's a very small number, but when we're talking about human lives and the risk of it, we can't be armchair warlords or armchair humanitarians when we have such risk seeing in front of us. And because of this risk and evidences from satellites and from journalists and their stories corroborate together, the international community would be complicit in this if this goes forward and we see the catastrophe that we're all warning about.
What about targeting those people who sell arms to, you know, belligerents? Who is arming these two sides?
Then we're getting into a topic that is always very interesting. So let's be straight as it is. Sudan has been at the very bottom of the international pecking order. And because of that, it's treated as diplomatic fodder. meaning that it can be used by any side, by those larger countries and hegemonies, for their own purposes. And because of that, we're seeing a lot of, I would say, in the normal understanding of IR in terms of relations, it's very weird. Let's take, for example, Sudan. Sudan's SAF being backed by Egypt, by Iran, by Ukraine. But at the same time, Russia is trying to be friendly with it. It's being backed by Saudi Arabia. It's being backed by Algeria as well, and their position within the UN as presiding over the UN Security Council. And then you have the
So this is the Sudan Armed Forces, the official army, right? So yes. RSF, who's backing them?
RSF, you have UAE, and there is a diplomatic fallout happening right now as we speak of the UK, UAE, and the UN. You got UAE, you got Libya with Haftar, you got, dare I say, Israel, because they've been selling weapons and arms to RSF as well. Then you have Ethiopia, you have Uganda. I won't call Rwanda onto that list, but it was interesting to see Hemeti flying to Rwanda and to the Genocide Museum by Kagame.
Hemeti being the head of the RSF.
And being the head of the RSF and being the same organization committing these very same genocides, to go to a genocide memorial, it's pretty much a slap in the face.
It beggars belief, actually. Irony upon irony, really, here.
Yeah, right, exactly. And this is what I meant by my point earlier in terms of just how weird these relations can be. So to make things even more weirder, you have the RSF who are currently plundering gold. And this gold, it's being plundered by the help of, previously it was Wagner. And then after the death of Prigozhin and Wagner being absorbed into the Russian military and became the Africa Corps, essentially the Russian state is on Hemeti's side, helping to extract this gold, which is then taken to UAE, and then from UAE, then taken to Russia. How else did Russia escape these international sanctions at the beginning of the invasion of Ukraine? It's through Sudanese and African gold. And we know that Wagner and its successor still maintains a presence within Africa, especially when it comes to mine industries and areas. And here's the weird crux. And because of that relationship, Ukrainian special forces are now on Sudanese soil fighting against the RSF and its Russian backers. But at the same time, the Sudanese government has always had a historical relationship with Russia. So it's interesting to see how Russia is playing two sides of these belligerents as well.
Al-Bashir Idris, monitoring events in Sudan. It's been less than 2 months since Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso launched a joint force to fight the jihadist groups plaguing their countries. It followed each of them kicking out the French troops, which had been tackling them previously. The general feeling was that the French operation, Barkhane it was called, had made little progress. This week, the coalition announced its first major operational success on Malian state TV.
The Malian army has succeeded where armies said to be the most powerful in the world have failed. Abu Huzaifa, known as Higo, a foreign terrorist leader and internationally famous and who plagued the Sahel, has been neutralized.
Abu Huzaifa, also known as Higo, was a commander linked to an attack back in 2017. That attack resulted in the deaths of 4 Nigerian and 4 US soldiers in Tongo Tongo in Niger. The U.S. has had a $5 million bounty on Abu Huzaifa's head ever since. Social media users in Mali echoed state TV's claim that this is the sort of victory that the foreign forces couldn't achieve. Is that an accurate claim, though? Aman Bezre is a political analyst who's helped us test the claim and understand the context. So we began with the basics.
Hi, Audrey.
Hi, Aman. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. Nice to be talking to you.
Lovely speaking together.
So I'm going to start by asking you to tell us about ISGS, this organization. Who are they?
So it's the Islamic State militant in the Sahel province. They were created in 2015. So what happened is that a faction of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in Mali defected and pledged allegiance to IS Central. So the founder of this group is called Abu Ali al-Sahrawi, and he was killed in 2021 by the French Operation Barkhane. So now the group is active in Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, specifically in Mali, Ngao and Menaka regions, and the tri-border area.
So they're the group that has been giving the French problems, basically, in that area, and
yes,
the people of
exactly.
Mali and other people in the Sahel.
Absolutely. So they are implicated in major human rights violations, specifically against the Tuareg communities, but they're also implicated in attacks against foreign forces. That was before they withdrew from Mali and other countries. I mean, the French.
So where does Abu Huzaifa fit in?
So Abu Huzaifa was one of the founders of the group. He came to Mali in 2012 as part of the Mujahid movement at that time, the movement for oneness of jihad, loosely affiliated with Al-Qaeda. To put him on the map, he was one of the founders of ISGS, very close to the founder that was killed, Abu Ali al-Sahrawi. Now, both of them hail from the Western Sahara, although the origin of Abu Huzaifa is a bit contested, with some saying that he was born in northern Morocco.
And they're not the only ones that were killed in that group of the leaders
Absolutely.
Of this organization. But tell us about the operation in which he was killed.
Of course. So the operation was actually an interesting development, especially because of the ambiguity of the forces that were involved in this operation. So I'll tell you what happened. On 29th of April, FAMA, the Malian Armed Forces, issued a statement saying that they have killed this ISGS commander the day before on 28th, and he was identified as Higo Abu Huzaifa. But the actual news came the day before from the Secretary General of the Movement for the Salvation of Azawad, the MSA movement. So the MSA movement is actually a Tuareg movement, a Tuareg armed political group, and is responsible for securing Menaka region where Abu Huzaifa was killed, but also parts of Gao.
So MSA, they are a militia that will be fighting the ISGS.
Absolutely. So because of that, apparently, FAMA, the Malian Armed Forces, did not really kill Abu Huzaifa. It was actually the MSA militants who killed him. So what happened is that MSA was searching for stolen cattle by ISGS, and they came across a camp in which Abu Huzaifa was there with his Fulani wife, and they worked on isolating him from other militants that were present at the scene. And apparently FAMA came in to distract the other militants, isolate Abu Huzaifa, and the actual killing was conducted by the MSA. However, FAMA took credit of that operation. Now, why did FAMA take credit of that operation? There are so many explanations for that, one of which is that this operation is quite crucial because Abu Huzaifa is a prominent ISGS leader, and FAMA wants to be relevant again in the global effort to counter terrorism, and want to say that even though the foreign forces withdrew from Mali, the Malian armed forces are still capable of conducting strategic operations to eliminate terrorist or jihadi commanders. But also, this is very beneficial for the MSA, for the Tuareg group, because they are under imminent threat from ISGS. So to limit revenge attacks, probably the MSA thought it was better to just give credit to FAMA and protect its fighters and its communities.
I'm wondering if this is widespread information and Malian state TV is making a big deal out of this, sort of claiming it for the Malian army, saying that their forces have achieved something the French couldn't. It's not really accurate. And how is it washing then with people? Because if you know this, I imagine that many people in Mali know this.
Exactly. This is how state propaganda works, right? Like, they want to come across as achievers, especially at a time where the junta in Bamako is going through a lot of trouble, especially that the transitional period has ended and now they need to make a decision about extending the transitional period or holding elections. So they are facing some domestic issues. So they need this achievement. So they're allowed to say that we've done some something that never been done before, but it's not true. So if we look at the French Operation Barkhane, we can see that actually the operation was very efficient in eliminating key jihadi leaders in the region from Al-Qaeda affiliated group.
So they've been quite effective in eliminating leaders, but how effective are these organizations in generating new leadership? In other words, what effect will the death of Abu Huzaifa have on ISGS?
That's a very good point. And I don't wish to be pessimistic here, but actually eliminating high-ranking leaders does not really affect a jihadi group. If we look at the historical operations where leaders were killed, it didn't really alter the group's effectiveness. But it is very symbolic. That's why it is important. But in terms of the group's operation, actually, the group might become even more violent in conducting attacks and enter this phase of revenge episode of attacks against civilians or fighters or national forces.
So 2 months since Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali launched their coalition to fight jihadists. How is that going?
They are trying to advance this idea that the alliance of Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali is going to be very effective in countering terrorism. But how effective it is, from what I can see, is that since the withdrawal of the French, the security situation has deteriorated massively. Almost every day, there is a terrorist attack or there is a human rights violation conducted by either state or a jihadi group. So the situation is not getting better. And I doubt that the alliance will be as effective as any other foreign forces that were involved in the fight against terrorism.
Just give us a background of all these jihadist groups that are operating in this region. Because if we say jihadists, we're bringing in a sort of religious element into it, right? But what is actually at the heart of it? And that's causing so much instability in the Sahel.
Okay, in terms of the jihadi actors on the ground, yes, the religious element is very important, especially that these groups are operating in countries and among communities that sometimes they would prefer to see fast justice or act of justice, which the jihadi groups provide. In its heart, it's difficult to say that there's one element of the conflict, but it's a multi-layered conflict where in its heart you can see that the fighting between groups is very historical and often over access to grazing land or water wells or over cattle. Like cattle is very important in these countries in general, in the tri-border area specifically, and often ISGS steal those cattle to feed the communities that supports them.
Okay. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Aman Bezre, a political and security analyst with particular expertise on the Sahel. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey! Are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The World Service. Now to something good and life-giving. Dr. Aristide Kamla from Cameroon has won the 2024 Whitley Award for work that is helping to save a marine mammal called the African manatee. And while he's at it, he's also helped preserve the livelihoods of the fishermen along one of Cameroon's largest lakes. The manatee were threatened by an invasive plant species called Salvinia molesta, which was choking off all other forms of life in Lake Ossa. Dr. Kamla found a way of killing off the plant. Through his organization, the African Marine Mammal Conservation Organization, he's trained fishing communities to protect the manatee, an animal they'd come to regard as an enemy because it destroyed their fishing nets. Now, if, like me, you've never heard what a manatee sounds like, listen up. There are three different kinds of manatee: the Amazonian, the West Indian, and the West African manatee, which faces the threat of extinction from poaching and entanglement in fishing nets. Dr. Kamla told me a bit more about his work and the manatee he wants to save. Well, let's start the interview, and I'm going to start by asking you, so what did you win the Whitley Award for, and tell us just a little bit more about the award itself.
I'm a marine biologist, and I work to protect the African manatee. It's this marine mammal that you find all along the west coast of Africa, from Mauritania down to Angola. But in Cameroon, there is a lake called Lake Osa, which is like the hotspot of the African manatee in the country. And a decade ago, there's been an invasion of a plant called Salvinia molesta, an invasive plant species that has been threatening the habitat of the African manatee, and with a serious negative impact also on the local community. And to address that problem, I've initiated what we call the biological control, which consists of using a weevil that feeds specifically on this plant. And that weevil has been able to clear more than 70% of that plant. And now the lake is recovering, and we're seeing more and more manatee coming back, and the fishermen do their fishing activity again. So that's why the Whitley Fund for Nature is supporting me to complete this fight, and also to help the local community gain a better livelihood, and also to restore the forests around the lake.
Right. So when you, did you say weevil? So that's a form of a bug. So does that eat the plant?
Yes. Yes, the weevil. The weevil is an insect. It's a tiny black insect that feeds on the plant. And when that insect feeds on the plant, so it is making some perforation on the leaves, and also eat the what we call the bed of the leaves where the new leaves are coming up. So that, and this is when the larva of the weevil will go and hide in that bird and will hijack the proteins that were that the plant was reserving for new leaves. So when that protein is no more there, so the plant can no more grow. And this is how the plant will eventually brown and die.
Why is the Salvinia molesta, that plant that you've managed to bring under control, so dangerous for the lakes and the environment in Cameroon?
So Salvinia molesta is a plant native from Brazil. So it's not a native plant in Cameroon. And when a non-native plant comes into a habitat, for the case of Lake Osa, because that plant finds itself in an environment where he had no competitor, it started spreading all over and even outcompeted the native plants such as Echinocora pyramidalis, a sedge, which is, by the way, the main food plant of the African manatee. So this is how, because of that plant evading, manatee could no longer stay in the Lake Osa. So they had to move into a different water system. And at the same time, that plant was also impacting the local community. Lake Osa feed more than 300 fishermen, and there are more than 17,000 people living around the lake. And as this plant invaded, fishermen could no longer fish in the lake because it was interfering with their fishing net, and also it was causing a decrease on the fish production, creating like that, you know, an economic crisis within the villages around Lake Osa.
Right. So you saved the manatee from starvation, basically from displacement, and the fishermen from losing their livelihoods in this way. Tell us about the manatee. They're such slightly comical looking.
The African manatee is a marine mammal. It's the only herbivorous mammal.
Herbivorous, so they eat plants. Okay, yeah?
Yeah, so the manatee are very gentle. Actually, I think if all the people on this planet could be like the African manatees, I think this world would be a paradise, because They don't cause harm to anybody. They just want to live their life, enjoying the resources. And and life goes on. So they're very peaceful animals.
How did you get to know them and fall in love with them?
So my encounter with the African manatee was actually an accident. During one of my class, when I was doing my master's degree, I was left with this topic that nobody wants to pick. I read that it's all those animals that are larger than 45 kilograms and that lives in the water. That was the first time I was reading something like the African manatee. And then, so this is where my curiosity started. I tried to look at where are they located in Cameroon. And after I was reading, I realized that the species is highly poached. And then, but there was nobody, no scientists working for their protection. So this is how, for my master research, I decided to focus on the African manatee. And this is what I've been doing till now. So it's more than a decade that I've been working to protect the African manatee in Cameroon.
Do people now work together to protect manatee, or is it particularly in Cameroon and the Lake Ossa that they are endangered because of the Salvida molesta and the others are fine?
So the African manatee is present in 21 countries along the west and central coast of Africa, and they spend most of their time in lakes and rivers. Now we are trying to build a network of manatee researchers across the continent. We have this plan of creating an African manatee conservation network that will bring all those researchers together to collaborate and develop a strong action plan for the conservation of the species across the continent.
And so how receptive are people that had previously seen the manatee as an enemy, those people who hunted them because they saw manatee destroying their fishing nets? Are they willing to conserve and help protect manatee now?
So when I started manatee conservation in Lake Ossa, fishermen were very reluctant about my conservation message when I was telling them, oh, don't kill the manatee because they are protected, because they are doing this, because they are good for this. They did not really care about my message until one day one of the fishermen came to me and said, Ariste, we're seeing you constantly on this lake, bringing some equipment to, like, you know, to study the manatee. It seems like the African manatee is more important than a human being. Like, you don't do anything for us. After reflecting about what that fisherman told me, I realized that he was right. I was so focused on the manatee that I forgot that this manatee lives in an environment where there are people, where they are human, the human component of the conservation. So it's at that moment we started now initiating activities also towards the local, the fishermen community, by providing them alternative livelihoods, by supporting them. And it's at that moment that this community started understanding our conservation message. So today, when we say protect the manatee, they're more cooperative than in the beginning.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
Dr. Aristide Kamla, founder of the African Marine Mammal Conservation Organization and winner of the 2024 Whitley Award, a prize for work benefiting wildlife, landscapes and people. Audio credit for the news clip from Mali goes to ORTM TV. Victor Silva, Rob Wilson, Patricia Whitehorn and Bella Hassan worked on the various items in the podcast. Paul Bajibinga was the producer in charge of keeping us all on track. Nick Randall was our technical producer, responsible for putting us on air and online. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right!
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
Thank you.
Lives Less Ordinary brings you remarkable personal stories from across the globe, from people who've chased their dreams.
No one knew that I was going to travel by bike. If I had told them that I was riding a bike to Egypt, they might have said that it was impossible.
To people who've lived through nightmares.
Being in jail in Thailand, I made a promise to myself in that jail that when I'm home, I'm going to volunteer somewhere.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.